Presumably, humane utopian interventions like compulsion schooling aren't always the blessing they appear to be. For instance, Sir Humphrey Davy's safety lamp saved thousands of coal miners from gruesome death, but it wasted many more lives than it rescued. That lamp alone allowed the coal industry to grow rapidly, exposing miners to mortal danger for which there is no protection. What Davy did for coal producers, forced schooling has done for the corporate economy. And Gatto begins the chapter with this quote by Henry Steele Commager. Every morning when you picked up your newspaper, you would read of some new scheme for saving the world. Soon all the zealots, all the come-outers, all the transcendentalists of Boston gathered at the Chardon Street Chapel and harangued each other for 3 mortal days. And they talked on non-resistance and the Sabbath reform, of the church and the ministry, and they arrived at no conclusions. It was the most singular collection of strange specimens of humanity that was ever assembled, wrote Edmund Quincy, and Emerson was even more specific. Madmen, madwomen, men with beards, dunkers, muggletonians, come-outers, groaners, agrarians, Seventh-day Baptists, Quakers, abolitionists, Calvinists, Unitarians, and philosophers, all came successively to the top and seized their moment, if not their hour, wherein to chide or pray or preach or protest. There was something artificial about the Chardon Street debates. There was a hothouse atmosphere in the chapel. There was too much suffering fools gladly, there was too much talk, too much display of learning and wit, and there was, for all the talk of tolerance, an un-Christian spirit. Close quote. The cries of true believers are all around the history of schooling, thick as gulls at a garbage dump. School principal Debbie Reeves of the upscale Barnwell Elementary School in an Atlanta suburb was quoted recently by the USA Today newspaper as the author of this amazing testimonial of true belief. Quote, I'm not sure you ever get to the point you have enough technology. We just believe so fervently in it. Close quote. It's that panting excitement you want to keep an eye out for. That exaggerated belief in human perfectibility that Tocqueville noticed in America 170 years ago. The same newspaper article wanders through the San Juan Elementary School in the very heart of Silicon Valley. There, obsolete computers sit idle in neat rows at the back of a spacious media center, where years ago a highly touted open classroom with a sunken common area drew similar enthusiasm. The school lacks resources for the frequent updates needed to boast state-of-the-art equipment. A district employee said, one dying technology on top of a former dying technology, sort of like layers of an archaeological dig. America has always been a land congenial to utopian thought. The Mayflower Compact is a testimonial to this. Although its signers were trapped in history, they were ahistorical too, capable of acts and conceptions beyond the imagination of their parents. The very thinness of constituted authority, the high percentage of males as colonists, homeless, orphaned, discarded, marginally attached, uprooted males, encouraged dreams of a better time to come. Here was soil for a better world, where kindly strangers take charge of children, loving and rearing them more skillfully than their ignorant parents had ever done. Religion flourished in the same medium, too, particularly the independent and dissenting religious traditions of England. The extreme rationalism of the Socinian heresy and deism, twin roots of America's passionate romance with science and technology to come, flourished too. Most American sects were built on a Christian base, but the absence of effective state or church monopoly authority in early America allowed 250 years of exploration into a transcendental dimension no other Western nation ever experienced in modern history, leaving a wake of sects and private pilgrimages which made America the heir of ancient Israel, a place where everyone, even freethinkers, actively trusted in a god of some sort. Without pope or patriarch, without an Archbishop of Canterbury, the episcopal principle behind state and corporate churches lacked teeth, allowing people here to find their own way in the region of soul and spirit. This turned out to be fortunate, a precondition for our laboratory policy of national utopianism, which required that every sort of visionary be given scope to make a case. It was a matter of degree, of course. Most Americans, most of the time, were much like people back in England, Scotland, Scandinavia, Germany, Ireland, from which domains they had originally derived. After all, the revolution itself was prosecuted by less than a quarter of our population. But enough of the other sort existed as social yeast that nobody could long escape some plan, scheme, exhortation, or tract designed to lead the faithful into one or another promised land. For the most part, Old Testament principles reigned, not new, and the prophets had a good part of the national ear. From 1830 to 1900, over 1,000 utopian colonies flourished around the country, colonies which mixed the races like Fannie Wright's Neshoba in Tennessee, colonies built around intensive schooling like New Harmony in Indiana, colonies which encouraged free love and commonly shared sexual partners, as did the perfectionists at Oneida in upstate New York. In the wonderful tapestry of American utopian thought and practice, one unifying thread stands out clearly. Long before the notion of forced schooling became household reality, utopian architects universally recognized that schooling was the key to breaking with the past. The young had to be isolated and drilled in the correct way of looking at things, or all would fall apart when they grew up. Only the tiniest number of these intentional communities ever did solve that problem, and so almost all vanished after a brief moment. But the idea itself lingered on. In this chapter, I want to push a bit into the lure of utopia, because this strain in human nature crisscrosses the growth curve of compulsion schooling at many junctures. Think of it as a search for the formula to change human nature in order to build paradise on earth. Such an idea is in flagrant opposition to the dominant religion of the Western world, whose theology teaches that human nature is permanently flawed, that all human salvation must be individually undertaken. Even if you aren't used to considering school this way, it isn't hard to see that a curriculum to reach the first end would have to be different from that necessary to reach the second, and the purpose of the educator is all important. It's simply impossible to evaluate what you see in a school without knowing its purpose. But if local administrators have no real idea why they do what they do, why they administer standardized tests, for instance, then any statement of purpose made by the local school can only confuse the investigator. To pursue the elusive purpose or purposes of American schooling as they were conceived about a century ago requires that we wander far afield from the classroom into some flower beds of utopian aspiration which reared their heads in an earlier America.